I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Back in 2003, if you tuned into a rock radio station in Canada, you wouldn't have to wait long before hearing a song by Avril Lavigne. Well, I guess that's actually still true, but it was especially true in 2003. Her debut album, Let Go, had just been released the year before, and it included singles like Complicated and Skater Boy. And back then, it just felt like Avril was everywhere. But what if she was nowhere? What if she was actually dead? And the Avril Lavigne that we were seeing in magazines and on Much Music was actually an imposter. This is Podcast Playlist. I'm Leah Simone Bowen. This week, we're listening to the best new and notable podcasts, and we're starting with a conspiracy theory that's been circulating online for over a decade. Who Replaced Avril Lavigne is a new podcast hosted by the Irish comedian Joanne McNally, and she's taking us down an internet rabbit hole to find the truth. Let's listen.
It turns out there's this whole collection of great information on TikTok. There's a reason TikTok is so popular. It's basically the modern library for people with no attention span like me. You can find out how to cook a carbonara, how to donate your own organs, how to burst a cyst. And you can also find out how Avril Lavigne is dead and was replaced.
This conspiracy has always freaked me out. Allegedly, when Avril Lavigne debuted in 2002, she found the fame incredibly difficult to handle, so her label employed...
I spent quite the afternoon slash evening slash morning slash afternoon again scrolling my life away. The result? I felt I was an expert on the theory. But I also discovered something else on TikTok too, something called the protege effect. It says the best way to learn is to teach. I was a teacher. I needed a student. Gro, thanks so much for taking the time to come into my studio. If I want anyone on board with me for this journey, it's you.
Okay.
Gro Farrelly is a comedian, but more than that, he's an Irish comedian. And even more than that, he's one of my best friends. And even more than that, he says I'm not one of his. You're a good balance of cynicism, but also delusion, which is what I really need right now.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I've been doing a little bit of work on a little known theory. I don't know if you're familiar.
Okay.
Avril Lavigne, who you know.
Yes.
Not personally, but you know of.
Yeah.
Canadian, did you know that?
No, I thought she was American.
I know.
She has kind of like Valley Girl vibes.
I did too, which I'm sure thrills the Canadians. There was a theory that Avril Lavigne is in fact dead.
Okay.
And was replaced by a woman called Melissa. I know what you're thinking. She's definitely dead.
That's not my immediate reaction.
You're thinking this makes complete sense from day one and I've no more questions. She's dead. Fair. She is either dead or has completely retired, like off the grid into the wilderness, no longer working. And there is some evidence to suggest that this is true.
I'm going to need to see all that evidence.
Yeah, that's okay. I knew you'd want evidence. I knew you would. That's good. That's healthy. You should want evidence. To help lay out the evidence, I drafted in a couple of experts. People I discovered on my internet deep dive. There's Silas Dean, host of the Creep Time podcast.
We cover all things that are chilling, mysterious and unexplained, and occasionally a conspiracy theory or two.
And fellow podcaster, Christiana Morgan-Roth.
I would also describe myself as a pop punk connoisseur, an enthusiast.
You'll hear them pop up now and again just to clarify things where I wasn't clarified. Because while they don't have official qualifications in conspiracy evidence analysis,
They know a lot more than me. I think the reason why she did so well at the time, everything was quite pink, bubblegum, poppy.
Yes.
Yeah. It was your one, blonde one. What's her name?
Christina Aguilera.
No. Other one.
Britney Spears.
Yeah. Avril Lavigne arrived at a time when manufactured pop was dominating the charts. Circa 2002. Here's Silas.
They knew like a young girl could sell, like a teenage girl could sell in the market because Britney had the success, but it couldn't be the same act as Britney.
So quite blonde, very pretty, sexy, virgins, you know, all that kind of vibe.
Okay. And she was like the, you know, the complicated person with the eyeliner.
Angsty. Yeah. Grungy. They kind of credit her with pioneering the pop punk scene. She married pop with punk. No, you don't agree?
Shampoo did that in 1995.
Okay, you're showing your age now, Gerardo. Which you're right, I don't know. But look, she's credited with it. She's credited with it.
It's gone into the podcast.
She debuts, and it's a huge success. The record was massive. It went number one in like Australia, the UK, the US. It was a huge debut for a 17-year-old.
Christiana.
As Avril is getting significantly more famous, she's finding herself, as any young woman would, very stressed out by the expectations that have been placed on her.
Okay, so this is where we come to the theory. So Avril's struggling to cope. She says to the record label, I can't do this anymore. She's like, I can't cope. I'm not coping. It's too much for me. And they're like, okay, no worries. Sit down, relax. We've got a double for you called Melissa Vandella. Right, so they got this woman called Melissa Vandella. Some people say Avril already knew her. Some people say they don't, that she was a complete stranger. And they brought her in to do the kind of low-level stuff that Avril, to ease the pressure of Avril. So, you know, just the shit jobs.
Like record the album, make the videos, do the interviews.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The work.
So like there was actually like a different Avril Lavigne, you don't know.
So all that difficult stuff that she was struggling with, Melissa started doing. Allegedly. Then we know that Avril's life came crashing down in 2003 when her grandfather died. This is a clip of her making an emotional public announcement to fans in Dublin, recorded by someone in the crowd.
This show tonight goes out to my grandpa who passed away today.
The theory goes on to suggest that Avril full-blown died. Record company got together and they're like, okay, things have escalated.
She goes on a really long hiatus. No press, no appearances, no interviews, nothing.
So they think that that was when Melissa went off to be trained up as the new Avril and that Avril had already passed.
So I get that that's the story, but those internet theories, they're usually quite light on the facts.
Mm.
Like, do you have any evidence? You look very upset.
I know you're a devil for the detail, which I don't appreciate. It's one of my least favourite traits in you, but I have brought facts for you, Gro, because I knew you demand them. So anyway, Melissa /Avril comes back. We'll call her Mavril.
Okay.
Comes back on the scene. Everyone's like, hold on a second. Avril's totally changed. She went from being really angsty, anti-establishment, cool rock chick, to a very, and these are not my words, but this is what the internet says, to a bubblegum pop princess in a relatively short period of time. She started smiling.
That sounds like they just got the dose right.
I know what you're saying. I know, yeah. It could be, she could be medicated. You're right. Yeah. She could,
meditation, medication.
They could have just given her a sound bowl and a candle. But yeah, her clothing style changed completely. Like she was famous for that rock chick look.
Yeah.
And then she went, here, look, hold on. I know the listeners can't see this, but there's Avril, the OG, right? I showed Garode a photo comparison. Christiana helpfully described what we were seeing.
Avril seemed to prefer wearing dress pants with white tank tops, a men's tie, etc.
Moody, that tie that she was always wearing.
Melissa seemed to prefer dresses, seemed to love wearing mini skirts.
That's a big change.
That's girly now. Pink dress, long blonde hair. All she's missing is a chihuahua in a little tiny bag.
Proper sorority girls.
She's gone proper sorority. Right, I want you to do some imagination at home, people. Or better yet, whack Spotify on,
pick your favourite Avril song from her debut album and listen along. The reason I'm asking you to do this is because, well, we can't afford the rights, to be honest. Off air, I played Garoud, Skater Boy and Complicated for free.
Complicated and Skater Boy, you'd be hard pushed now to find
I know.
Better pop songs.
They're brilliant. They're like, what do they call them? Little earworms? Is that what they call them?
Bangers.
And then you've more recent songs, like for example, this one called Hello Kitty. Lyrics here, very different. Let's play Truth or Dare now. We can roll around in your underwear. How every silly little kitty should come a kitty kitty. You're so pretty, pretty. Don't go kitty kitty. Stay with me.
That sounds like somebody doing a TikTok to promote their OnlyFans.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hello kitty kitty, dirty kitty. It's not, it doesn't sound like her.
I also think that if somebody had presented that to the old Avril,
she would have gotten sick on her tie. Actually, that song was co-written by Avril and her one-time fella, Chad Kroeger from Nickelback. Do you remember them? Back in the days of Polly Pocket and Tamagotchis. And there was two other lads in the band called David Hodges and Martin Johnson. So maybe it was one of them who was into the whole kitty kitty lyric thing. I don't know. Who could tell? I wasn't there.
That was a clip from the podcast Who Replaced Avril Lavigne. It's produced by What's the Story Sounds in association with the CBC and the BBC. It's hosted by Joanne McNally, and their team includes Callum McRae, Daryl Brown, Sophie Ellis, and Sarah Clayton. When the pandemic first began, across the country, there was a noticeable spike in the population of homeless people. Big cities like Toronto have had people living on the streets for a long time. But now there are encampments appearing in smaller cities and towns across Canada, where homelessness was never a visible problem before. In Halifax, the rise has been particularly stark. According to the Globe and Mail, the homeless population there has tripled in just the past 3 years. In a recent episode of their podcast, City Space, the Globe looked at how things in Halifax got to this point. Let's listen.
People in shelters are often experiencing mental and physical illness. Substance use disorders are common, and the risk of violence is always present. The province says they're putting up drapes at the Halifax Forum Shelter in an attempt to introduce a little privacy, but a shelter is not an apartment or even a hotel room.
We know shelters are not ideal. We know that they're not a long-term solution for many people. We know they're not a solution, at all a solution for some people.
The new shelter at the Forum often has empty beds. People just aren't going there. Before the rise in homelessness in Halifax, there were enough shelters, but there also weren't that many people who needed them. So even if a few of them chose to stay outside, it wasn't very noticeable on the street. Then, shelters dropped their capacity to prevent the spread of COVID, and at the same time, the homeless population was rising. Suddenly, you could see a lot of tents around the city. Now, in addition to the existing spaces, new shelters are opening up, but it's much more obvious that people are choosing to stay outside. To help us properly understand why those beds stay empty, we spoke to someone who has needed a shelter themselves and who works with people who still do.
My name is Gail Colligott. I'm the manager of supported housing with the Elizabeth Fry Society of Mainland Nova Scotia.
Gail became homeless at 16, and after that, she worked in harm reduction, going to encampments and helping the people who lived there. So if there is an encampment in Halifax, she knows about it. Gail says it's a different city than it used to be for the homeless population. And the people who are homeless, they're different too.
Before, it would be like when I ended up on house, I was having problems at home as a teenager, so I ended up at Adsum House. But now we're seeing families hiding in tents, RVs, scared to accept support because they're terrified that means Child Protective Services is going to come and apprehend their children if they're under 16. We are seeing widows and widowers out in tents because their spouse passed away, their home foreclosed, or they couldn't afford the rent. And they had well-paying jobs too. Like, there was a librarian out in this for a minute. Retired librarian. Anyone can fall victim to it now.
How has homelessness in Halifax changed between when you were homeless and now?
So when I was homeless, I could get kicked out of a shelter and go down the street to the other one and get a bed and then leave that one and go to another one, referred to group homes. There would be 2-3 rooms available. So not hard to really bounce around until something permanent came along. And then I became pregnant at 18. So DCS had no choice but to offer me a lease.
I want to pause for a second there because it struck me that when they really felt they had to, the Department of Community Services found Gail an apartment. They're admitting something there, if not openly. They're admitting that the shelter system is no place for a pregnant woman. Gail's situation was rightfully treated like an emergency. But what does that say about how we view everyone else's place in the system? Because until she got pregnant at 18 years old, Gail was just a kid finding her way around a new city.
So I remember being very overwhelmed because I'm from Chester, Nova Scotia. And so even to me, Halifax was this big, huge city. Chester's not very diverse. I was very thrilled about all the diversity, meeting different people, exploring every bus route imaginable. Like, it was very exciting, like, because I had this independence I thought I wanted so bad, and I didn't have my parents controlling me anymore. But there was still barriers of control, like the curfew, sharing rooms with like 3 other people you may not get along with, being exposed to things you didn't think you'd ever be exposed to. I remember going to the smoking room of the first shelter I was at and seeing 2 residents smoking crack, and I had no idea what it was. And them getting very angry at me for walking in that communal smoking area. Like, now there's no more smoking rooms in these places, but it was just kind of like, okay. One time when I was walking home to Phoenix House, I got jumped by 2 people that had been my friends, presenting as my friends. The police broke up the fight. The police would not help me whatsoever. So I had to like walk home to my group home, very upset that people would do these kind of things. But I'm really grateful for the exposure of everything. I learned a lot. I wouldn't be who I am today. So there's some comfort in it.
What would you say is something that people get wrong about homelessness?
Well, there's a big stereotype of all of them are on drugs, which is not true, even when it wasn't that bad in the early 2000s, late 90s. The welfare queen label, people are lazy, they just don't want to work. Well, there's working people literally out in this. People that work for the province, these are people with pretty decent salaries, but they got hit with a fixed term lease, or they lost child support payments. Like, there's so many layers to people's situations, even if it's just an income issue. And there's also a lot of discrimination. This market is so competitive now.
Do you ever get asked why people living in tents don't just go to shelters?
Oh, all the time. We just had a winterized shelter open up at the Halifax Forum. And it's not at capacity. And of course, people are judging them for not going. I don't blame people for not wanting to live in a shelter space, whether it's one where you get a bedroom, whether it's a pallet shelter, when there's rules or you have experience with, like, you have trauma from shelter staff, I can understand why people don't want to go. So I think a lot of it has to do with like curfews. And if it's a dry shelter and you're navigating a substance use disorder and people don't view it as a disorder, they just view it as like you're a junkie, then why would you go there?
From the Globe and Mail, that was City Space. It's hosted by Irene Gallia. Their team includes Jay Coburn, Kyle Fulton, and Kate Kilmore. If you want to recommend a new podcast you're loving, email us, podcastplaylist@cbc.ca.
A lot of people think history is boring, and depending on how you were taught, that's pretty understandable. If history to you is just memorizing a bunch of dates and names, well, yeah, that's bound to make the subject feel pretty dead. But if you were lucky, maybe you had a teacher who helped you see that actually history is all around us, woven into the fabric of everyday life. That's the way Simone Polonin likes to think about it. She's the host of Past Perfect, a history trivia podcast, and the former host of Not Past It. It's a story-driven show about the links between the past and present. Simone Polonin joins me now. Welcome to Podcast Playlist.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So for those who haven't heard it, can you explain how the format works on Past Perfect?
Yes. So Past Perfect is a, you know, trivia show. So what we do is we invite guests to come on and we play different rounds of trivia, and they each have their own theme or style. So, for example, we have like a guess the lyrics round, or we have an audio round where we play clips and people have to answer questions based on those, or a which came first round where we're giving you two historical events and you have to guess, you know, which order they came in. So we like to switch it up.
And how has creating history podcasts changed your understanding of your own identity and the world we live in?
Oh, it's honestly, it's changed a lot for me. I feel like it's kind of reframed how I think about time, and it's made history in general just feel a lot more immediate. Because a lot of what we do is we explore the roots of things happening today, and we kind of trace them back and try to understand, like, where do these phenomena come from? And for me, I live in New York City, and I just feel like I'm so much more aware of, like, all of the lives that have passed through the places that I go to on a regular basis, whether they are, you know, big notable ones that have their own historical plaques, or whether they're maybe not documented, or maybe it's just like, you know, you see a photo of the corner that you go to, that your favorite bar is at. And it's sort of, I find myself imagining all of the previous lives that have passed through these spaces. And I feel like it, one, it helps me kind of zoom out from my own little granular life and be like, ah, yes, life is resplendent and we are all connected. And like, you know, there are much more important things than like, how many times did you make it to the gym this week? But it also makes things feel very consequential. And like, you know, there are a lot of things happening right now that I think are difficult to digest. And it also, I think, brings out the immediacy of those moments as well.
Oh, and so while you've been making Not Past It and now with this new show, have there ever been any historical figures or events that you wanted to cover but then couldn't cover?
Oh, yes. Okay, yes. Eartha Kitt. Eartha Kitt is somebody that I would love to talk about. I have been a fan of hers since I was like a little theater kid, you know, being traumatic in my bedroom by myself. Her experience at the White House and attending Lady Bird Johnson's luncheon and subsequently getting blacklisted from Hollywood and sort of like, you know, quote, polite society. That's a story that is very interesting that I would love to explore. But I would also love to uncover maybe the lesser known parts of her life. I just think she's such a compelling, vibrant figure. I don't think the culture knows about her enough. I could talk about Eartha Kitt forever. Yeah.
Yeah. She's very incredibly modern in most of her perspectives on things.
Yeah. Very, very ahead of her time for sure.
So you gave a TEDx talk a little while ago where you mentioned that making Not Past It helped you realize history was closer to us than you thought. Can you explain a bit what you mean by that when you say that it's close to us?
Yeah. You know, I think you hear the phrase history repeats itself, you know, and there's a difference between kind of like understanding that logically and then really kind of getting that in your bones. And I feel like the more history stories I started to tell, the more I was really seeing that like a lot of the things that we're going through right now are just extensions of things that have happened, that have been happening, that happen over and over again. And one example from that TEDx talk was we talked about Josephine Baker, and we talked about her experience getting blacklisted from entertainment, from show business. In her case, she was sort of accused of being a communist in the midst of, like, you know, the Red Scare, and that essentially slashed all of her professional opportunities. But we kind of recontextualized that story in the context of, like, cancel culture. And something that is really frustrating for me is, like, when people talk about cancel culture as if condemning public figures is like a new phenomenon. I make the argument that perhaps these consequences now extend to, like, a larger group of people, but there have been people that, like, have had to tiptoe in the public eye and, like, watch what they say and have to be very intentional about the image that they portray. And not just because they're saying inflammatory things, you know, some of these things are just tied to their identity and, you know, whether or not they can occupy the space they're in with boldness, right? How much permission they have to do that. And so that, I would say, is, like, one very specific example of how I have liked to use history and, you know, just remind all of us that, like, hey, these are not new things. And
same as it ever was.
Yeah. And also, like, we have the tools to deal with this. Like, let's not act, you know, brand new. Like, we've been here, you know?
In a moment, we're going to listen to a little bit of the first episode of Past Perfect. We asked if you had a favorite episode and you picked this one. What makes it special for you?
Yes. I mean, all of the episodes are really fun. But this one I recorded with Saeed Tijan Thomas and Emmanuel Jochi, who are both podcast hosts in their own right, and they are IRL best friends. And it was just such a blast to record. They have a great dynamic. They love to rib each other. And it's an exploration through, like, 1980s pop culture. So, I mean,
ooh, you know, very fun.
All good things.
Well, I'm so thankful that you joined us on the show today. Your show's really fun. It's a good historical journey. I'm a big history nerd myself. So I'm just, nice. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Simone Polanin is host of the podcast Past Perfect and Not Past It. And we reached her in Brooklyn, New York. We're going to listen to some of Past Perfect now. Here's Simone.
Well, get your cross colors and your boom boxes ready, guys, because it is time to get into our 80s trivia. So let's jump into our first round called
Round One, Which Came First?
So for this one, I'll tell you about two moments in 80s history, and you'll need to tell me which one of those two moments occurred first. And our first question today is going to Emmanuel.
Hell yeah.
Are you ready?
Ready, Freddy.
All right. So the early 80s were a big time for the U.S. and its relationship to the cosmos. We sent our first woman into space, astronaut Sally Ride. And on the fictional side of things, we got a visit from a funky little alien, Steven Spielberg's E.T. My question to you is, which came first? Sally Ride blasting off into space or E.T. chilling with a young Drew Barrymore?
E.T.
It's funny because E.T. in my mind always feels more like a 70s movie.
The question you need to answer is, did they put an alien on Earth before they put a woman on the moon?
Wait, was it the moon?
It wasn't the moon. It wasn't the moon.
It was space.
Which actually, okay. that's a very helpful clarification for me because, you know, they stopped doing the Apollo thing. So this is, I'm going to go with E.T. came first.
That is correct.
There you go.
Sadly, that is correct.
There you go.
Yeah. We got a visit from the fictional E.T. first. E.T. premiered in L.A. on June 10th, 1982, and Sally Ride didn't launch off into space until a year later in June of 1983. All right, next question is going to you, Saeed. Now, if you were a kid in the 1980s, you probably remember the many advances in video gaming. Think Mario, Zelda, Tetris. Then you also had the popularization of some lower-tech fun in the form of the slap bracelet. Maybe you remember that from the playground.
Yeah, it's the slap bracelet.
Mm-hmm. So which came first, Nintendo's Game Boy or the slap bracelet?
Damn, that's a tough one. High-tech or low-tech? Okay. So yeah, the thing that's throwing me off is, did they figure out how to make portable, you know, gaming before they slapped bracelets on people's wrists? I wanna say this is easy. I just wanna say I'm gonna go with the slap bracelet.
Saeed, that is correct.
Let's go.
Okay.
Yes, the slap bracelet was invented in 1983 by a high school shop teacher from Wisconsin.
Wow.
Yeah. The original slap bracelets consisted of a long piece of steel covered in fabric, kind of like a fabric-covered tape measure.
Mm.
Nintendo's Game Boy didn't come out until 1989, so pretty late
that
in the decade.
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes a lot more sense.
This next question is for you, Emmanuel. And for this one, we're comparing the world of sports to the world of nuclear disasters.
Oh,
love that connection.
Yeah. So which came first? Michael Jordan being drafted into the NBA, or
1984?
The Chernobyl disaster. And that was when a nuclear plant exploded, sending toxic radiation as far as 150,000 square kilometers, which is about the size of the state of Illinois.
Damn. Did you watch that series?
I did. That was so stressful.
Oh, Chernobyl on HBO. Yeah, yeah.
It was a fictional miniseries and, you know, facts were stretched. But even, it's like one of those things where, you know, you read those articles where it's like, the facts of the actual history, here's what they got wrong.
Uh-huh.
And you're like, oh, so it's worse.
Oh.
So they just amalgamated that character, and actually there were many more people who suffered this way.
Right.
Oh,
you're just like,
damn.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I guess the question is, did they seem like they were aware of Michael Jordan in the midst of their suffering?
No. No. That's what was so interesting. That's why it's blocking me, because this is just experiencing my ignorance. I'm just gonna say Chernobyl came first.
Wow. You used, I feel like, every single synapse in your brain to figure that out.
I thought you were gonna really do me dirty and say you use every synapse in your brain to be wrong.
Well, you were wrong.
No.
Sorry.
Perfect.
Brutal.
Never bet against Michael Jordan.
Sorry, Emmanuel, but
that's painful.
Michael Jordan was drafted by the Chicago Bulls first back in 1984.
Uh-huh.
You were right about that. And he would go on to be arguably the greatest basketball player of all time.
Mm-hmm.
The Chernobyl disaster, which took place in what was then the Soviet Union, now Ukraine, occurred on April 26, 1986.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wild.
Well, on that note, we're going to go to our last question of the round, which goes back to Saeed. All right. In the 1980s, America saw Oprah's career really taking off. Her local Chicago daytime talk show went national. And around the same time, she was also nominated for an Academy Award for her supporting performance in The Color Purple.
Oh.
My question is, which came first?
Ooh.
The Oprah Winfrey Show getting national syndication.
Today, how to find a husband, how to find a wife.
Or Oprah's Oscar nom.
Oprah Winfrey in The Color Purple.
Oh, man.
I mean, it has to be the national syndication, but because the way I remember it, she got big, and then that's when she did the Color Purple.
It's your question. I'm just like, I just want to push your logic a little bit. Like, she was doing the show even while she was making the movie.
Yeah, but like, you do the show, you get big, and then you get an opportunity to star in The Color Purple, and then you get an Oscar nod.
Mm. But maybe she was already big in Chicago. And national syndication.
In Chicago?
National syndication.
They were like, Chicago, Oprah, do you want to be in The Color Purple? Think that's how it happened?
Look, I'm just saying, stranger things have happened in movies.
I don't think you book The Color Purple, then get an Oscar nom. So I'm going with she got the national syndication before she got the Oscar nomination.
Saeed, that is incorrect.
I am sorry.
I tried, brother.
How you were like, nobody was like, hey, Chicago Oprah, do you want to be in The Color Purple?
Spielberg was.
That's exactly what happened.
That's literally what Spielberg did, yo.
So,
I tried to help you, brother.
I'll tell you the story. So, yes, Oprah got her Oscar nomination before her show went national. The story goes that movie and music producer Quincy Jones was in Chicago in 1984.
Quincy Jones. He's behind everything.
Truly. Like,
he
actually.
Is, yo.
He saw a young Oprah hosting the local news show AM Chicago, and he recommended her to director Steven Spielberg, who then cast her as Sophia in the film The Color Purple, which earned Oprah an Oscar nomination.
Wow.
Yep.
I'm so sorry for doubting you, Oprah.
All my life I had to fight.
From ZSP Media, that was Past Perfect. It's hosted by Simone Polanin, and the guests in that episode were Saeed Tijan Thomas and Emmanuel Jochi.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
It's now been 8 years since Canada legalized medical assistance in dying, also known as MAID. In 2022, doctor-assisted death accounted for 4.1% of all deaths in Canada. That puts us second in the world behind only the Netherlands. Recently, the government was considering expanding access to MAID to those with chronic mental illnesses. But after facing significant pushback, they delayed that decision until 2027. The new podcast, The Ultimate Choice, follows a couple named Michael and Anne as Michael makes the choice to end his life through MAID. It's hosted by investigative reporter Rob Cribb. And as he starts to dive into this story, he has to come to terms with his own family's history. Here's Rob's mother, Nadia, talking about her late husband's struggle with Alzheimer's. And just a note to listeners, this podcast contains mature themes, including death, suicide, and chronic illness. Please take care while listening.
In the middle of the night, I got up to go to the bathroom, and I had put the chain and the extra lock on the door before going to bed. And I noticed the door, the chain was open, the door was closed but unlocked. So, of course, I was very disturbed, and I thought someone broke into our room. And
she's talking about a road trip she took with my dad, Jack.
I laid in bed thinking, how did they get in? Your dad was in bed sleeping. I waited until he woke up, and I said to him, I said, did you hear anything last night because the door was open? And he said to me, he said, well, I was all over the hotel. I was looking for a place to sleep, and I checked every door, but every door was locked except this one, so I came in here. We drove to Florida, but it was awful. And I started out, and I bought a bell, put it on the door, and asked him to help me move everything movable to put it behind the door. And then I started for Nova Scotia. And I tell you, it was very difficult. Putting the bells on the door every night, moving furniture and so on. Prior to that, every time a conversation comes by about people getting old and having, they didn't call it Alzheimer's, they called it old age sickness. He used to say to me, because his father had that disease and his grandfather had it, and he used to say to me very strict orders that if I lose my memory, I want you to give me a bunch of pills. I don't care what they are, but I want you to help me not to go through this phase. I don't want to live. And I used to laugh at him, you know, and I used to say, Jack, I'm not going to give you any pills because it's against the law, and I'd go to jail.
I never really knew much about that conversation. I keep finding out more from my mom, and it's opening up this whole new idea. My dad actually wanted his life to end, should it ever get to that point. That's not the man I knew. As a kid, I'd sit at the top of the stairs in our home during adult dinner parties and watch how he commanded the room. He'd masterfully narrate jokes, held them spellbound, deliver the punchline, filled the place with laughter. He'd pull out his saxophone, play Duke Ellington, Count Basie tunes. They'd dance. He was the literal life of the party. But he was also a successful banker whose charm and savvy got him an office in a Manhattan skyscraper when I was a kid. On weekends, he'd teach me music and take me to ball games. He was kind. His words were carefully chosen. His opinion, when he gave it, mattered. I wanted to be him in every way. He was, to me, the model of a man who lived life to the fullest. Learning that he asked for help to die, it didn't fit with who he was to me. I see that differently today, and so does my mother. Today, that conversation she had with him might have a totally different outcome. Doctors in Canada now have the legal right to help people like Jack and Michael. And I've been spending time with Anne and Michael to figure out how this even works. If Anne won't assist Michael, who will? Michael calls his doctor for help. That's next time.
Sometimes doctors are criticized for playing God. I think in the case of Maid, playing God would be saying no to a person. Then you would be deciding when and if a person dies, whereas affirming a person's decision is understanding your true role.
When it comes right down to it, I'm still going to be sick. There's nothing the doctors can do. So all the money in the world really isn't going to help me because nothing will change.
Coming up this season?
Because I've been suicidal for the last 20 years, it's kind of like my mind's little holy grail.
I would say that it gives the medical system an out when you abandon people. One person's empowerment is another person's abandonment.
And at least this way, he went on his terms, and it was his choice to make. He needed to end his life. And I had to be the first one to respect him for that. And I had to be the one who walked with him through that whole process.
I just can't imagine ever being able to do what she just did. I'm just the reporter. I mean, she's lived it.
If one looks at the numbers of Canadians who have a diagnosis of mental illness, it's very high. Should that disqualify you from all your rights?
There hasn't been a slippery slope. We've had a cliff. We've had no slope. We've had a cliff, we're falling off it, we don't know how far we're going to fall, and we have gone in a trajectory that no other country on the planet has gone.
Who are we to say, well, you're not suffering enough?
And I think it's unfair to say to somebody, chin up, you might get better in 10 years.
Mr. Speaker, the safeguards simply aren't working. And the heads of psychiatry at all of Canada's 17 medical schools have called for a delay to the Liberals' deeply flawed MAID legislation that will expand eligibility to those with mental disorders. So will the Prime Minister...
This story is wrapped up in legislation and medical ethics and politics. But at the end of the day, what's it about? It's about raw human experience and choices of people in desperation trying to figure out what is the right thing to do. This is what it's about. This is the rubber hitting the road.
That was a clip from The Ultimate Choice. It's produced by TVO Today in association with the Toronto Star and the Investigative Journalism Bureau. It's hosted by Rob Cribb. Their team includes Bruce Edwards, Damian Kearns, Ian Thompson, and Jess Alvarenga. If you've ever wished you could listen to your favorite recipe blogger talk about how they develop a dish, this next show is for you. The Recipe with Kenji and Deb is a new cooking podcast hosted by Kenji Lopez Alt from Serious Eats and Deb Perlman from Smitten Kitchen. Every episode looks at one recipe, and this clip we're about to hear comes from their first episode about mac and cheese. Let's dig in.
Kenji, I made your very famous three-ingredient macaroni and cheese recipe. And I think it's a really unique recipe. I don't think there's any others like it or nothing else that I saw. And I want to talk about why. And I have a few questions for you.
So the main difference is that the existing recipes that are out there have you cook the pasta directly in milk and then stir cheese in at the end. And I actually tested this when I was working on my recipe. And I took that step out because of foolproofing, because I found if you weren't careful, the milk would scorch.
So your three ingredient mac and cheese is part of a can of evaporated milk. Right. You use some grated mild or medium cheddar cheese or any good melting cheese. You say you can use Fontina, Gruyere, Jack. And then you've got uncooked pasta, macaroni shape. And what I find so interesting about this, because this is a one pot recipe, like you're not cooking the pasta separately and then making a sauce, it's all right in there. Correct. Which is really a dream of for speed. Almost every time I make a dish, no matter how fond over it is on the internet, how many times it's gone viral around the world, when the pasta is cooked in the sauce, something's always missing for me. There's always like an edge missing in the pasta, or I feel like it's a little gummy.
If it's cooked directly in the sauce, you mean?
But that didn't happen here. And I want to know how you pulled off this magic. So we start with, you've got your dried pasta. You just cover it with water and then you bring it up to a boil. And so it does start by cooking in water. And that might be why the texture doesn't get that weird sort of soft edge gumminess. You basically add the sauce at the right time to not ruin the texture of the pasta, which is incredibly clever. So you knew this because you said you had tried to make mac and cheese recipes where you cook it in the milk, and what had happened?
Well, what happens is that the danger is that the milk scalds. The pasta does get a little bit more of that sort of gumminess. Not too much, because you know that gumminess comes because most sauces, like if you're trying to cook your pasta in a tomato sauce, for instance, the sauce is acidic, right? And starches, like they don't soften the same way in acidic environments. And so, yeah, your pasta ends up taking longer to cook and also getting a little bit gummier than it does if you cook it in just plain water. Milk is generally not, you know, not particularly acidic unless it's very old milk. You don't really have that texture problem as much. But the main reason I switched from milk to water is because the milk would scorch if you're not careful.
Yeah, you have to stir it. It gets to, as it evaporates. And we don't really have that issue here, but I was so expecting it. So talk to me about the evaporated milk, because I feel like in a million years, I would have never thought to use evaporated milk. And I also don't know how many people keep it around. Like, is evaporated milk just milk that's been like cooked down, maybe reduced by half? Or is there more to it?
Reduced by more than half. But yeah, ostensibly, it's just been cooked down and reduced. Although I think realistically, they take all the constituent parts of milk and then and then blend it back into some kind of, you know, Franken milk. I think that's how they make it. Maybe the old-fashioned way would be to actually boil it down. But now I think it's like they take milk protein and milk fat and mix it to the exact right ratio and then stick it in a can.
It's really, it's a really interesting product. It must have come on the market as a way to, you know, stabilize milk production, you know, have an inexpensive way that you could always have milk in the house, even if you hadn't gone to a store, because our milk doesn't last long. And so is that how you just... You just knew that it was going to work here?
So the reason evaporated milk works so well is because, so there's milk proteins in there that help emulsify the cheese sauce. And when we say emulsion, we're talking about like making sure that the fat in the cheese doesn't separate out from the liquid, you know, and then making sure that the proteins in the cheese don't all just clump together and turn into like a stringy kind of mess that can happen. The higher the concentration of milk protein you have in there, the easier it is to form that emulsion. Just using a can of evaporated milk, I find, is a more foolproof, more reliable way to do that than to actually just try and boil the milk down yourself.
If you didn't have it and you boiled the milk down, though, would it work? Or it's just not the same?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You just have to be a lot more careful and make sure that the milk doesn't scald. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, you can use the same recipe and just swap water out at the beginning for milk and leave the evaporated milk out of the recipe. So basically, cover the pasta with enough milk that you can boil it and then reduce that milk down until it's very concentrated and the pasta is fully cooked, and then you stir in cheese.
But again, scientifically, it works to make this cheese sauce, but also because you're not cooking the whole thing in milk, you're cooking it in water for the first half, you end up having, you don't lose any of the creaminess because you're using like double concentrate milk. So you feel like it tastes like it was cooked in milk, but without actually having the issues that come with it.
Yes, and it's more reliable.
So after you've cooked the pasta most of the way in the water, and most of the water is gone, and then you add the evaporated milk, and then you add your grated cheese. And I have to tell you, I trust you, Kenji, but I was like, there's no way this is going to work. There's no way this is going to work. It's going to curdle. Like, you can't cook cheese. It doesn't work. Like, it just splits. You know, what is cheese? It's like milk solids and fat.
Right.
I mean, and that's what, and they just, it splits. That's how you get those kind of clumpy bits and greasy bits, and you like think something's gone wrong. But in general, if you cook cheese, this is what's going to happen. You can make it like delicious and aesthetic by making like Frico cheese crisp. But in general, it's not going to. So I'm adding this cheese to this mixture and I'm cooking it, because for me, I'm going to add, when I usually add cheese to a recipe, I'm going to then take it off the stove or have it off the stove already because I don't want it to split. But you let us keep cooking it. And I'm like, this is going to be a disaster. And it wasn't. It was so good.
It came together.
So it's all because of this evaporated milk?
It's partly that. It's also the, you know, the starchiness of the pasta water. So when you're when you're cooking pasta, there's starch from the pasta that leaches off into the water. When you toss pasta with sauce at the end, when you're about to serve it, you always want to add like a splash of the the reserved pasta water back into it to help it emulsify. It's the starch in there that's helping it emulsify. You know, it helps it thicken up a little bit. When you're cooking the pasta down in water and you're not draining it at the end, you know, you're just cooking the water down until it evaporates, none of the starch leaves. And so you have that really sort of hyper concentrated pasta water in the bottom of the pot. So it's almost like making a bechamel, but without, you know, without the extra fat and without the extra step.
And you end up with a very thick, creamy, like really rich stovetop mac and cheese. Like, it's really decadent.
Yeah, like a gooey stovetop mac and cheese. It should be, I mean, I like to think if you do it right, it ends up kind of glossy, you know?
Definitely glossy. And there's definitely like, it looks iconic. Like, I would take a picture of it with my phone and it looked like it came out of like a fancy restaurant or a food ad, because it's it has that opacity. It has the orange. It has the thickness. Like, you can barely see the definition of the pasta, you know, texture, which is like a goal.
Yeah.
And it's really incredible.
From PRX and Radiotopia, that was The Recipe with Kenji and Deb. It's hosted by Kenji Lopez-Alt and Deb Perlman. It's produced by Jocelyn Gonzalez and Pedro Rafael Rosado. And that was your podcast playlist for this week. If you like what you heard, you can find links and more info for everything we played today at cbc.ca/podcast playlist. Podcast playlist is Julian Uzielli and Aili Yamamoto. Technical support from Laura Antonelli. Our senior producer is Kate Evans. Our executive producer is Cecil Fernandez. I'm Leah Simone Bowen. I'm going to go make some mac and cheese, I think.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.